good evening. It's the hour of 7 o'clock. We like to start on time. We know your time is valuable. Good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation. This is our 17th season of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster at the back, Haiwan Wan, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of southern Ohio, although his family have Louisville roots. He attended schools in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and Burlington, Vermont. And growing up, he wanted to be a veterinarian and was influenced by his father. His interest in biology developed from catching critters in the woods on the back of his father's farm and from some great biology professors at college. He attended Colby College in Waterville, Maine, where he received a BA in biology, and then enrolled in the graduate school at the University of Washington in Seattle, where he received a PhD in zoology in 2004. From 2005 until 2009, he was wildlife biologist for the Department of Wildlife Management in Barrow, Alaska, before accepting teaching or research appointments at the University of California, Berkeley, the University of Alaska at Anchorage, and the Ohio State University. He joined the biology faculty of WKU in 2012, and in 2015 was appointed the L.W. Lancaster Professor. His fellowships and grants have exceeded $1 million and have focused on the ecology of sleep, immune-sleep interactions in mice, and how sleep loss affects the immune system of organisms. In 2016, he was awarded a National Science Foundation research grant to study sleep patterns of Arctic songbirds in Barrow, Alaska. This 5-year grant is expected to total $965,000 by 2021. Here to tell us about birds of the Arctic, his project, and what it all means, please welcome Noah Ashley. Noah.
Well, thanks, Brian, for that very nice introduction. Really appreciate that. So I'm going to tell you about, first of all, a little bit of the characteristics of Alaska that I've kind of learned through my 18 years of working up there. And before I get to that, I just want to show this poster that was the poster kind of showing what my talk is going to be about. And this actually, for those birders out there, this is a bird that is not found in Alaska. It is a zebra finch, which I have a colony of my own, and there's a picture on the web of me holding this bird. But it's definitely not an Alaskan bird. So I thought I'd replace that with an Alaskan bird, a Lapland longspur, which I'm going to talk more about. And you probably might have gotten more attention if I was holding like a snowy owl or even maybe a baby polar bear, you know, or just some snow, because we Alaska, it's just going to be a lot of snow there. So, but anyway, I'm just joking around. But I'm very happy to be here and talking about Alaska critters. So my outline is just, I'm going to first bring you up to speed a little bit on what the Arctic is all about and the types of environments that you'll see in the Arctic. And then I'll just present a fairly brief survey of Arctic birds. I will talk about some non-songbirds, but for the most part, I'll concentrate on songbirds that I've studied up there in Alaska. And I'll also end with talking about my current research projects that are going on up in Alaska. So if you take a look at the circumpolar Arctic, here is the North Pole, and there is a circle that surrounds this area that's called the Arctic Circle. And the Arctic Circle is at a latitude of 66.5 degrees north. And anytime you pass above that circle, you're going to experience at least one day out of the year that is constant sunlight. Okay, that's what we call the midnight sun. Okay, so and the farther north you go, the more time, the more days that are going to have that continual daylight, constant illumination. And so for birds and for other animals that spend time up in Alaska, they have to deal with these really weird light patterns and issues. And humans as well, okay? And because of this constant illumination in the summertime in Alaska, you can grow some really big vegetables, okay? Now, this isn't in the Arctic. This is actually lower down in Fairbanks, Alaska. But they can grow some world record pumpkins, zucchinis. I mean, these things are huge. And this one probably weighs almost a ton. So the reason for that is because of the constant illumination that occurs throughout the 24-hour cycle for an extended period of time. Also, you might know that because of the angle of the sun and where it hits the Earth as the Earth rotates around the sun, there is a smaller angle to where the sun hits the polar regions compared to directly onto the equator, right? So because of that, you're going to have colder temperatures on average than you would, say, in Bowling Green. Okay, so Bowling Green, this is showing you in blue and red are the average monthly high and low temperatures in Fahrenheit. And as a comparison, in a place that I've worked at it a bunch, Barrow, Alaska, at 71 degrees north latitude, it's a lot colder. I mean, a lot colder. So here's the freezing mark, 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees Celsius. As you can see, it just gets a little bit above freezing in the summertime, but then plummets in the fall and in the wintertime. And this is just an average, mind you. So I've been in Barrow in January and February, and I've experienced negative 60, negative 65 temperatures, which can be pretty darn cold. So everything pretty much stops working then. You have to basically just stay in your house and watch TV during that time. Also, what a lot of folks don't know is that the Arctic is a desert. There is not a lot of precipitation in the Arctic. Okay, so again, showing you the comparison between Bowling Green. Here is precipitation in inches. And Bowling Green gets, you know, quite a bit of rain and sometimes snow, although not this year. And then if you can compare Barrow precipitation and also the Sonoran Desert, it's about the same level of precipitation that occurs. So even though you will see a lot of snow up in the Arctic, most of the time that snow is just blowing around a bunch and forming drifts, but there's just not a lot of precipitation up there. So it's very dry most of the year. So what I'm going to talk about today is a part of the circumpolar Arctic, and that's Alaska. Okay, so Alaska is a big state. It's our biggest state. And you may be familiar with Anchorage, which is the largest city in Alaska. And then Fairbanks is about 200 miles or so north. I'm going to talk about an area of Alaska that is just north of the most northern mountain range in the United States. It's called the Brooks Range. Okay, very beautiful set of mountains. Fairly low elevation compared to, say, Mount Kinley, which is the highest mountain elevation-wise in the United States. But I'm talking about this, what we call the coastal plain of northern Alaska. And that's where most of our work, or my work, has been involved with, is what we call the Arctic tundra. Okay, so once you get past the Brooks Range, you're going to be in an area of Alaska where it's just low-lying vegetation, okay? And there's no trees, okay? So there's no trees at all. Trees cannot survive on the Arctic tundra for a couple of different reasons. One is that it's pretty cold for photosynthesis to really produce woody plants. And number two reason is because of permafrost. So permafrost is frozen soil. Okay, and plants really can't grow in frozen soil. Okay, but there's a very small layer up top that's called the active layer, where smaller plants can grow in that soil, and that soil will melt out in the summer and spring during the melting season. So I've worked and lived in a town called Barrow, Alaska. Barrow is the farthest northern town in the United States. It is right at the tip of Alaska. It's all the way up here. Okay. Here is the Arctic Ocean. And there's two seas, the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, make up those two parts of the Arctic Ocean around Alaska. And it's a pretty unique place. And the amount of continual sunlight, it runs from the middle of May, so the mid-May, around May 15th, the sun rises, and then it never sets until early August. So there's 83 days of continual sunlight during that time. Okay. Now, it's great if you want to get a suntan, right? That's, you know, it's actually pretty nice, but you'll get sunburned if you don't wear sunscreen during the summertime. It's also a town that is an Alaskan Native village. And this is, and there are a number of other smaller villages along the coastline here, but Barrow is the largest town, around 5,000 people. Most are Alaskan Native. And what's really neat about this culture is that they are subsistence hunters, probably one of the last traditional hunter-gatherer societies in the world, in fact. And their major food source is the bowhead whale. So they will hunt the bowhead whale, they'll harpoon the whale and bring it into shore, and then they'll cut up the whale in the ice and then feed their families with this important food resource. And then, of course, when there is, that's the summertime, but no one ever talks about really that much about the wintertime and how much darkness there is, but it gets flipped. So starting November 17th, the sun goes down, and it doesn't come back up until about January 20th or so. So you have 65 days of darkness in the wintertime. And this is a picture of some polar bears that I took that were feeding on a bowhead whale skeleton during that time. So Barrow is one of the few places in the United States that has polar bears routinely go through town. Okay, so they are around, and they're actually having a hard time with global warming. So I'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. This is my house in Barrow. Was my house. And the first thing you'll notice about houses up here is that they're built on little stilts. Does anyone know why that is? Why?
Flash flooding.
Not so much flash flooding, although that can occur in the Yukon Delta. That's a possibility. But the major reason why you have stilts is because if you built a warm house on frozen ground, guess what would happen to that house? It would sink further and further further down into the ground. So you have to build everything on stilts because of the permafrost. And of course, this is in the summertime, and this is the wintertime. So there's a little more snow. This is actually, I think, in April. But the snow blows around quite a bit. There's always a constant wind where you get these really big snow drifts that come in. This is just me on a snow machine trip, I think in February, tracking some caribou when I was working for the Department of Wildlife Management. It's probably negative 40 degrees outside, and you have to dress really warmly. And then, of course, my friend, my guide, who was part of the trip, Billy Adams, he had this ingenious method of keeping his face warm. He would put duct tape on his face to keep it warm, and it actually worked pretty well. So duct tape can be used for anything. It's amazing. This is what a typical tundra environment looks like in the wintertime and also the spring. All right, not much relief going on here. It's very flat. It's flat as a pancake. But the one thing that really limits bird populations is not the cold per se, and I'll talk more about why that is, but it's actually the lack of food, okay? Because the snow is typically covering over their food sources, all right? So snow has a big impact upon when birds come to breed and hang out in Alaska. It's almost like living on the moon when you are in this landscape in the wintertime, because it just it's like no other environment that you're probably used to being up there in the wintertime. But that being said, Alaskans are pretty smart. During the wintertime, we just go to Hawaii. So here I am with my three kids in Kauai. Yeah. So, but actually, the wintertime isn't as bad as people think, and you have some beautiful, beautiful northern lights that come through. I've seen some spectacular shows in Barrow where we only get greens and Barrow, but just dancing lights. And Fairbanks gets the reds and the yellows, but it's just an extraordinary time to be up there. So I recommend it for anyone who wants to go up to Alaska in the wintertime. You will see an amazing light show up there. Okay, so moving on to animals. I am going to talk about birds mostly, but I did want to bring up some mammals that you might be familiar with that live up in Alaska. And these animals are going to be living up in the Arctic year-round. Okay, so, and there's some adaptations that they have that allow them to be able to cope with the Arctic environment on a year-round basis. This one is a walrus. Walrus and polar bear, they have very thick layers of fat that is called blubber. So the blubber really allows them to retain internal body warmth. Okay, the muskox, also a really sort of prehistoric looking creature that's found up in Alaska. It has some of the warmest fur out there. It's called kiviat, and it's folks will use it in their clothes up there. It's extremely warm coat of fur. And then lastly, some mammals will, the way that they'll deal with the cold winters of Alaska is that they'll hibernate. So Arctic ground squirrel is an amazing hibernator. It can actually lower its body temperature to below freezing, if you can believe that. So it's basically totally frozen, except its tissues do not freeze, which is pretty impressive. So it is an amazing extreme hibernator that you find up in Alaska. Okay, so those are some of the mammals. Now let's talk about some of the birds. There are 11 species of birds that can live up in the Arctic year-round. Okay, you may have seen some of these before. Snowy owl. Snowy owl is going to be a owl species that you can find any time of the year in Alaska and in the Arctic. Has these really cute chicks here. Deer falcon is another one. Deer falcon is a carnivorous raptor that can also be found any time of the year. And the raven, the common raven, is found almost everywhere in Alaska. But it can subsist year-round because these three species basically are going to rely on meat. And they can survive in the wintertime because they basically will use carcasses that have previously been used by polar bears, wolves, etc. Okay, so they're able to feed on those carcasses and survive over the wintertime. Now the other species, the ptarmigans, they can also survive throughout the wintertime. The rock and willow ptarmigan, and also some of these gulls. So Ross's gull, ivory gull, and some of these seabirds, black guillemot, dovekie, and thick-billed murre, they are seabirds that can also survive. And I'll show you in a second how they do that in the wintertime. And then very impressively is the redpoll. This is a songbird right here that is chickadee size, but can actually survive very, very cold temperatures. So very, very impressive. And the way that these gulls and seagulls survive marine birds survive is that in the wintertime, you have these openings in the pack ice that form, and you get a lot of productivity in these little, what they're called plenias, these little openings in the pack ice, and this is where they hang out in the wintertime. And the reason why you have those plenias is because there's this warm upwelling of ocean water that routinely flows into that same area every year, and that's where you typically find them, and that's how they survive, because that's where the food is. For birds, down. We talked about this in my ornithology class. Down is a type of feather in birds that is close to the skin. And as we probably know, down is one of the best insulators out there. Okay, it is able to trap air. And by trapping that air, you're able to remove that convective loss of heat that occurs at the boundary layer between the skin and the environment. It's so effective that we have a famous mountaineer, Ed Vesters, who climbed all seven summits throughout the world, the highest peaks, in his down jacket, right? So very, very effective insulator. In addition to down, birds have other adaptations. So for instance, in the ptarmigan and also snowy owls, not only do they have feathers around their body and head, but they also have feathers on their feet, okay? Because they're going to be standing on the snow quite a bit. So they're going to have feathered feet, which typically you don't see a lot of feathered-footed birds. Okay, so we know this is an adaptation that occurs in birds that occur in high latitude places, and this the foot structure of the ptarmigan also allows them to act like a snowshoe, where they're able to walk along the snow without falling in too much. So that's another key adaptation that you'll find in these birds. In addition, ptarmigan, when it gets really cold out, one of the things they'll do is they'll bury in the snow, okay? And you think, well, that doesn't make much sense, but when there's a big storm that comes through in the Arctic and it's blowing, you know, 40 miles per hour and the wind chill is negative 40, they can easily bury into the snow and escape those really, really cold environments. And just to play a quick sound of what a ptarmigan sounds like, the reason why I'm showing this is because it's a very hilarious call, and it's one of my favorite calls. Oops, we can do it. I love that call. It's amazing. It's one of my favorites. So most of the birds that come to the Arctic do not live there on a year-round basis. So about 90% of all birds that breed in the Arctic are going to be migrating from lower latitudes. And so the question is, well, why do they even come to the Arctic? You know, if they're in a warmer place with potentially more food out there, then why would they even come to the Arctic? Well, there's a couple reasons. There's a couple hypotheses. One is that there's a very predictable flush in insects during the summer months in the Arctic. And the reason why that is because insects grow very well when there's 24 hours of sunlight out. Okay? So, and that is a pretty predictable peak for the most part, although there have been some changes in that over the recent years. And that gives birds a reliable time to be able to raise their young and allow so that they can make sure that their chicks, when they hatch out of the eggs, that they're able to feed their chicks and those chicks are able to survive. But there's some other reasons why. Typically, there's a lot less competition because there's less birds around, okay? And there is some evidence that there's less parasites and disease in the Arctic compared to temperate environments, especially the tropical environments. And there's also, on average, less predators. Okay. Now, that being said, there are predators up there, but there tends to be a lot more predation pressure, typically lower down in the temperate and tropical latitudes. This is a picture of the Arctic coastal plain during the summertime. And what should strike you with this picture is that it basically is a wetland. Okay, and that's because that active layer on top of the permafrost melts away and becomes liquid, and it doesn't evaporate because it's pretty cold for the water to evaporate a lot, and also the water has nowhere to go because right below it is permafrost. Okay, so it's an amazing place for many birds to breed in this landscape, and that's why you have. And I'm not going to talk too much about ducks or shorebirds, but there are tons of shorebirds and ducks that come up to the Arctic to breed. Okay, so just to give you an example, these are eiders. These are marine ducks that you will find. There's only four species, and you'll find all of them up in Alaska on the North Slope. Common, king, spectacled, and Steller's eider. There's a number of different duck species that come and breed here, and also many different types of shorebirds. So it is, I basically call it the Serengeti of the North, because there's this huge migration in the spring, and it is quite amazing how many types of different birds will breed up in Alaska in the summertime. Just to give you examples of how far they go, I like to give the example of the Arctic tern. The Arctic tern is a bird that probably experiences the least darkness of any bird out there. The reason why that is because every year it migrates from Antarctica to northern Alaska every year. So in the summertime, when it's continual light in Alaska, it's going to breed. And then when it's summertime in the Antarctic, it gets the best of both worlds and migrates down here and hangs out in the Antarctic. But it's a long flight, obviously. So, but very impressive migratory feat of these birds. And you see them up in Barrow as well. I do want to point out this songbird called the northern wheat ear. And it's a really neat species because it also has a very long migration. There's actually two populations that are distinct from each other. One breeds up in Alaska, the other in Greenland and part of eastern Canada. And if you look at their migratory patterns, they fly to different places. And I'll just give you a quick taste of what their song sounds like. And they like to breed in rocky environments, and they're pretty much insectivorous. But the ones that breed in Alaska migrate. They actually live in the wintertime in eastern Africa. So in the wintertime, they are hanging out with elephants and giraffes and what else is there? Cheetahs, okay? And then they make their one-month migration to Alaska, so they'll make stopovers in the Persian Gulf, in parts of Central Asia, and up through Siberia, and eventually they'll make it all the way up to Alaska to breed. So incredible trip that I would love to make myself someday, but they do this every year. Okay, the other population migrates to Western Africa. So Alaska birds, they're international. You know, they're from different places all over the world. I talked about the northern wheat ear. The Siberian blue throat comes from India. You have some other species that I won't have time to talk about today. But as you can see, Arctic breeding songbirds and other birds come from a variety of different places around the globe and migrate in this particular area in Alaska. Okay, so I want to move on to some birds that we've been studying up there in Alaska, northern Alaska. The first is the red pole. We talked about how the red pole can be found any time of the year up in Alaska, up in the Arctic. This is a picture of one of us holding red poles. They used to be divided into four species and then two, but we found out that they're really hard to distinguish, so hoary red poles and common red poles, they do have some plumage characteristics that are different. The hoaries are a little bit lighter, and they only have sort of a reddish cap. And then the common red poles look like they have a breast that's dipped in raspberry jam. But the problem is that the intermediate forms, we really didn't know what species they fell into, so we just call them red poles. And again, it's the smallest bird to survive in the Arctic year-round. And the way that it does this is that it grows more feathers in the wintertime to give it more insulation. And they tend to eat a lot when it's cold, so that's a benefit because they need to have some energy in order to maintain their body temperature. And they also have a specialized organ that many birds have that is an outcropping of the esophagus that is able to allow these birds to hold seed without actually digesting it. So what they can do is they'll eat a lot of seed, they'll stuff their little faces full of seed during the day, and then at night when they can't feed, they will use those stored seeds for energy at night. And there are some songbirds that can that exhibit what's called nocturnal hypothermia. They actually lower their body temperature to save energy, but red poles actually don't do that. Here's their call. They're about the size of a chickadee, and in the hand, they are just cute as a button. Let me just tell you, they are super cute. They have these little beady eyes. I Okay, moving on to another songbird, the Lapland longspur. So this is the species that I study the most up there. This is a male. It has a characteristic chestnut nape, we call it. This is the back of the head, the nape. And then it also has this sort of executioner-style mask that goes around here. The bib is black, and the head is black as well. And it will breed up in northern Alaska, of course, but it will winter down in the lower 48. And they have been seen here in Kentucky during the wintertime. Here's a male again in the hand, and then here's a female. So they look definitely different. The female has more buffy plumage. But it is the most abundant songbird of the Arctic. Okay, so very, very abundant bird. And there's probably, I think, a projection of about 3 million or so that are found in the Arctic. So very high population. In Alaska, they arrive between mid and late May from their wintering grounds. And the thing about Alaska and the Arctic in general is that the breeding season is pretty short, okay, because there's only a short period of time where you get that insect flush. It's very short and rapid, so you have to be able to pull off a whole, you have to be, you know, basically be able to breed, to incubate your eggs, to feed your chicks, and to help raise those fledglings. Those are chicks that have left the nest, and then eventually migrate back down to the lower 48 within 6 to 7 weeks. So it's very fast. And because of that, their breeding cycles are very synchronous with each other. A really cool display that these males do is we call it the parachute display. Because what it really looks like is a bird flies way, way up in the air, a male does, and when he's displaying on his territory, and he basically will fly pretty high, and then he'll just spread his wings, and he'll float slowly down, like as if a parachute is landing on the ground. It's really cool to see. And they also sing at the same time. Here's an example of their song. Sounds like a rusty kind of bike chain sound. <It's> beautiful. But they're amazing to watch and see. And these are some chicks, some Lapland longspur chicks and eggs. And I think I have a little movie of where I'm trying to find a nest. The first movie that I did of this, I couldn't find the nest. I was like, here's a Lapland longspur nest. I was like, oh, I can't find it. So they're very well camouflaged. But here is the movie.
Sorry, I did finally find this nest. Here we go. The females aren't on it, but this is a Lapland. Lapland longspur nest, 5 eggs.
So you can see that they actually line their nest. This is mostly grass, but this, what they actually do, this is pretty cool. They take feathers from ptarmigans, and they put their feathers into the nest to make it warmer. You know, so pretty neat. Okay, the other bird that is up there in the Arctic, especially the high Arctic, is the snow bunting. Okay, they're also known as snowbirds. And again, their sexual dimorphism, males look different from the females, which are below. They will also be found in the lower 48. And they also have a very distinct song. And if you're not used to it, it can sound a little bit like a longspur song, a Lapland longspur song. But this brings back memories for me because living in Barrow in the summertime, these guys can call at like 2 a.m. in the morning, like totally wakes you up. But they're amazing birds. So the males actually come to northern Alaska in late March, early April. They come up to Alaska, fly up to Alaska about 4 weeks earlier than the females. And the reason why they do that is because nesting sites are actually limited, unlike the Lapland longspurs that have open cup nests in the tundra. These birds will either nest in cavities, but if there are birdhouses put up, then they'll nest in the birdhouses. Okay, so it's been found that males that arrive the earliest get the best birdhouses. Okay, They also nest in weird places. I've seen them nest inside the engines of tractors, ATVs, trucks. I've seen them nest in all sorts of pipes. And this is actually Chase Knibbe. He was a field assistant. He found one nesting in a construction cone. So, and what's cool about these snow bunnies is that they the males will feed the female on the nest. Okay, so the male, and this allows the female to stay longer on the nest because it's been found that inside these birdhouses, they're a lot colder than the open tundra because there's not light getting inside. Okay, it's not warming up the eggs. So they have to stay a lot longer on the nest than longspurs do. And so the males are forced to have to feed the females. This is a typical day or night in Barrow. I actually can't tell you what time of the day it is because it can be difficult to tell you what time of the day it is. But because there's usually a cold fog that rolls over off of the Arctic Ocean. And this is to give you an example of this the type of topography you'll see in Barrow. These are what we call polygon tundras. And the longspurs will nest around tundra. Yeah, so they'll nest around these little polygons. And in the backdrop is what is called the Arctic, Arctic Research, Barrow Arctic Research Center, okay? The reason why I stumbled there is because they originally were gonna call it Barrow Arctic Research Facility. But the acronym just did not sound great, okay? So it's called Barrow Arctic Research Center now, BARC. How do we catch these guys? How do we catch these birds? There's some little tricks that we use. One of them is that we use what are called potter traps. This is my son Asa helping me bait some traps. And Luke George is using seed to put into these traps because the longspurs love seed. They'll walk into these traps, the trap door shuts behind them, and then the bird is caught. The great thing about having your son work for you is that he works for candy and Legos and that kind of stuff. We also use mist nets. Okay, so mist nets, they're not that effective in Barrow because there's a constant 10-mile-per-hour wind or so, but occasionally when the wind dies down, we will use them. We also use some specialized clap nets that are trigger-loaded. We pull on the string. It closes over the nest. It's good for catching birds on the nest. We also will put special bands on birds. This is my graduate student, Lakin Cooper. She's banding a longspur. It's in her hand there.
It's a male Lapland longspur.
Those are the bands we put on to each bird. It has a unique number associated with that band. So if you ever recapture that bird, it's you can tell which what individual that is. We also, once we catch a bird, we will take a variety of measurements. And because we also look at hormone levels, we will take blood samples in the wing vein as well. And we can bring those back to the lab and measure hormone levels. And then these are some of my field assistants. Actually, these are high school students that are from Barrow. Katie is weighing. This is how we weigh the birds using a Pasola scale. And Vera is measuring different components like the wing length, the tarsus length of birds to get an indication of size. And this is a picture of banding a bird with a metal band. So one of the things that's kind of come out of these studies is the fact that even though Arctic breeding birds that come up to Alaska to breed every year are exposed to this continual summer daylight, okay, the midnight sun, they still maintain a circadian rhythm. Okay, so circadian rhythm is a rhythm that occurs throughout a 24-hour cycle. Most animals that are exposed to a light-dark cycle, it gets dark during the night, that change in lighting basically synchronizes their circadian rhythm. Okay, but Arctic breeding birds, they lack that. They lack that cue. So, but they still maintain a rhythm. And so for these long spurs, it's kind of a frenetic rhythm, but from 4 a.m. to about midnight, they're pretty much active throughout the whole day. But there is a period between midnight and 4 a.m. where they become a little bit more quiescent and less active. Okay, so so that kind of led us to think, okay, so when are they able to sleep? Because sleeping is obviously important for many organisms. And so we think that they're only sleeping about 4 hours or so a night for the entire 8 weeks that they're up there. Okay, so that's pretty impressive form of sleep patterns that you'll see in birds. We also showed that there's a circadian rhythm in melatonin levels. So melatonin is a hormone that's secreted by the pineal gland, and it is only secreted at night. Okay, but there is no night up there. So, but it's curious that even though there is no night, there's still a peak around that time when they're supposedly sleeping. We actually don't have enough data to support the fact that they are sleeping, but at least we know that they're inactive. They're not moving around a lot. So as part of this, it's a relatively new grant. We received this grant last year. We were able to only spend a couple weeks up in Barrow this past summer. But one of the things we're going to do is to actually measure sleep in these birds, in longspurs and snow buntings. And we have some kind of nifty transmitters that we're going to put on birds that one is going to measure their movement patterns. So we have these specialized little chips that we put on the back. Here's a snow bunting that has this little accelerometer on the back of it. Every time that bird moves, it's recorded in that accelerometer. We also have what are called neurologgers that are able to measure brainwave activity in birds, in free-living birds. So we are going to hopefully put some into some birds this June and July. And from that data, you can tell whether or not an animal is awake in REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep or non-REM sleep. Well, besides just looking to see when they're sleeping, we also want to manipulate sleep. So what happens if a longspur or bunting gets more sleep than they usually get? Or what happens when they even get less sleep? Are there going to be costs? Or are there going to be benefits? So that was one of the major questions we're trying to answer. So to do that, we can actually increase their sleep by using melatonin. We'll give them melatonin implants, which will make them sleepier, and we'll look to see how well they do in terms of defending their territories, producing clutches of eggs, raising chicks, and so forth. So that will increase their sleep, but we also want to give them caffeine. So we are experimenting right now with trying to figure out the best way to deliver caffeine to birds. There have been really no studies ever done. It's really weird. They look at caffeine in birds, except maybe a couple chicken studies. But they don't count. So we're going to try to implant some caffeine into these birds and see if this is going to affect how well they are able to breed, basically. So that's the manipulation part of the study. And then the last part of the study is we're going to do a latitudinal comparison of two species of birds, the Lapland longspur that breeds, again, in northern Alaska, and its close congener, which is a chestnut-colored longspur that breeds in Montana and North Dakota. And so what we have planned to do is to capture some longspurs, put them on Alaska Airlines, fly them all the way to Nashville, drive them up to Western Kentucky, and I have some aviaries set up to house them. The same thing is going to happen for the chestnut-collared longspurs, and we're going to compare how well they respond to experimental sleep loss. I have this kind of nifty little cage that I've set up that basically interrupts sleep in these birds by having a moving perch that slowly awakens them. We're going to look to see how resilient Lapland longspurs, the northern species, is going to be to sleep loss compared to the temperate breeding species. Okay, it's going to be a logistical nightmare, but I hope that it works out. All right, I want to also turn to some educational things that are really part of this grant. So one of the things that I've done in the past is I've hired some students from Barrow High School to help me with the project. Now I'm getting involved, again, Academy students. So we're going to have this kind of cross cultural kind of exchange where you have Gatton Academy students and Barrow High School students working in the field together, performing some research projects. And it's really cool because obviously the Gatton Academy students are very bright and gifted, but the Barrow High School students have a lot of traditional knowledge about a lot of these species, so it's a really cool interchange of ideas. And then we do a bunch of community outreach in Barrow and some of the neighboring villages. It's always fun to see a little kid hold a bird. So she's holding a snow bunting right now. So that's always a lot of fun for kids to hold birds. Also, what I'm really excited about is a collaboration with SkyTeach that's part of WKU. And I've been working with Dr. Martha Day, who's been wonderful. She is developing the STEM internship program that involves having a couple of WKU students go up, travel up to Barrow and also conduct the same lesson in South Central Kentucky schools and presenting them with a modules that talk about Arctic adaptations and birds. So I'm really excited about this project. And actually, we're going up in a couple weeks, I think. Right, so March, we'll be going up during spring break. And we're going to be going up to the Barrow High School and teaching some students about more birds. So really excited about that opportunity. And I want to end on this one key concept that you probably have heard a lot about, global climate change. We may not feel it so much in the lower 48, but I've lived in Barrow for 5 years. I've worked up there for 18 years. It is a magnitude order of difference that climate change has impacted Arctic environments, much more so than Kentucky, although it seems like this year it's just tropical weather out there. But there's some huge effects that have happened, and we can't deny them. For instance, this is the polar ice pack in 1980, basically covering over most of the Arctic Ocean. Now it's been minimalized to this size here. An incredible volume of sea ice, permanent sea ice, ice pack has been lost. And so it really is the animal that's going to be most affected by this loss of sea ice is the polar bear. Okay, so the polar bear is on the verge of, it's already been listed as threatened and endangered. It's going to be on its way out here in the next 50 years or so. It's been projected. So, for birds, there are some changes as well. And I talked about that peak insect abundance here that happens where birds will time when to breed when those insects emerge. Okay, so if you have climate change, typically you're going to have advancement of that insect peak. It's going to occur earlier on in the year. And so birds are going to have to lay their eggs earlier on in the year as well. Okay, but that becomes problematic if there's a lot of snow that has covered their breeding grounds in March or April. Okay, so even though it is causing a shift in their breeding dates, so I can see here, this is date of first arrival. We're seeing that from 1975 to 2010, birds are showing up earlier and earlier on the breeding season. Okay, so it definitely is impacting bird populations. But we don't really know what's going to happen from a population-wide level in terms of whether or not the populations are going to go up or down. So it's kind of a question mark. But it is impacting birds. Okay, with that, I want to thank a number of different folks. Dr. Melanie Rector, she's my current postdoc. She basically runs the Alaska Project. Lincoln Cooper is my graduate student. Dr. Kathleen Hunt, she's a long spur expert. Dr. Chase Knibbe, he's an undergrad, and I don't have time to say all their names, but these are all the Barrow High School students that have worked with me in the past. They've been great to work with. I also want to acknowledge my funding sources, NSF, Gatton Academy, for working with me, the Native Corporation, Ukpiavik Inupiat Corporation, WKU, SkyTeach, Faraway Places, and my mentor, John Wingfield. He was my PhD mentor. He really got me involved with Alaska. And lastly, I want to thank my family for letting me go up to Alaska every year. This is my son, Asa, when he was 2 years old, I think. He grew up in Barrow for 2 years, so he lived up there for a little bit. And this is my daughter, Sabine. She's also in the audience. She's in a snow cave that we built in Kentucky. That was last year. These are my two younger sons and my wife, Mandy. She's holding a snow goose during our snow goose banding extravaganza. with that, I thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
Questions?
What finally put you into this? This is fascinating.
Yeah, it's an amazing string of events. I basically started working up at a place called Tulik, which is a little bit further down, further south along the Brooks Range, with my advisor at University of Washington, Seattle. He was working up there, and that's how I got really involved with Arctic breeding birds and their life cycles. Yeah.
When you showed your house, how in the name of the dear Lord did you get that snow away from it?
The question is, how did the snow get moved away from her house? Yeah.
We have friends that have loaders that would basically push the snow away. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question back here.
Who maintains the database for the bird banding numbers?
It is the USGS. It's actually part of the USGS. It's not Fish and Wildlife. And it's called the Bird Banding Laboratory. And what's really cool is that, and I've had a couple of instances where ornithologists or wildlife biologists have caught some birds in the lower 48 that were banded in Alaska. So they can report them to the bird banding laboratory. You can, that's one way you can see where they migrate to and from, is using that information. It's a good question.
Are there implications in your study of birds? I guess the obvious is for human sleep patterns.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Because we always try to tie it to humans. I mean, that's how you get funded. But there are many different populations up in the Arctic that have to deal with the same lighting conditions. And what's really interesting is that during the summertime, you have some folks that live up there that will go what we call upside down. They, instead of waking up in the morning, they wake up in the evening, they stay up all night. So you have this almost flip in their circadian rhythm. So we really don't know that much about how Arctic communities deal with that. They deal with it in some ways, but basically their activity levels get extended quite a bit in the summertime compared to the wintertime.
And there is that famous film everyone's seen, I think, the guy who gets sent to Alaska and in the 24 hours of light and goes crazy because he can't get the blackout block out the light.
Right. Yeah, there's a couple of really good films about that in Alaska. Yeah, so.
Other questions? Something you're dying to know? Yes.
Yes.
What's your favorite bird?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. I really like the Lapland Longspurs. My all-time favorite is probably the Cory Bustard, which is found in Africa. But I like all sorts of birds. There's the only ones I don't really like are maybe starlings because they're just everywhere. But they're invasive as well. But besides that, they're just fascinating to me.